our good thoughts. Our good thoughts. First of all, be sure you know where to find them. And go, as the Old Testament tells us, to the far ends of the earth to find a wise man who will give you wisdom. And it's not easy to find. Wisdom is rare. Once you find it, get it. And allow it to enter your minds. And then nurture it. And Buddhist literature exhausts the vocabulary of agriculture in describing, speaking of course symbolically, describing how careful a farmer is when he's got something that he wants to grow. He will first of all make sure that the seed is good, that it's in the right place. He knows how to water it and care it and care for it and all the things that I know nothing about agriculture. But, speaking symbolically, how careful a person is and how sedulous he is, that the thoughts which he, by his faith, considers good, will mature, will fructify. Does that language sound familiar? Then, right attentiveness. Now, by this time, by the way, you see that the kind of operation, and of course how much, maybe years have been spent in doing this, but you see the concentration on thought, don't you? The concentration on ideas, because by a prior, you might say, attitude of both Hinduism and Buddhism, everything is interior, it's in us. And to realize that the human spirit is highly productive, and that whatever else that human spirit does depends ultimately on its thoughts. In other words, intellectual productivity is the condition for all other kinds of productivity. When I see a tall building like the Empire State of New York, for example, one of the thoughts that regularly crosses my mind, I think of the concepts in the person's mind that plan this. And of course, for the Buddha, how unimportant these structures become. Because you see, it's the concentration is from the outside in. Well, once he's got the person inside of himself, then, and by this time, by the way, the right speech and action have been taken care of, or at least presumptively, by stage 6, which is, 7 already, isn't it? You're pretty near Nirvana. It means then that there is, by this time, what we would call contemplative action, or better, contemplative attention. And here, this has helped me immensely in, for example, in dealing with religious and in studying the spiritual life. And by the way, one of my dearest friends among the Jesuits, let me tell you a little story, was a man by the name of John Chrysostom Chang. We first met in Rome, where we were in studies together. And he was writing his thesis as I was writing mine. Mine, incidentally, on the relationship of Protestants to the mystical body. I was always interested in saving them. He wrote his thesis on the Chinese interpretation of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. We spent many hours together. I was teaching him English, and he knew very little. He knew a little more after he finished. We were using Italian as the medium of exchange, walking the streets of Rome, seeing the sights in the meantime. He was a little man. He was novice master of the Chinese Jesuits, and this was a time when the communists took over, so he had to, at least he was told to leave China, and he came to Rome to pick up a doctorate. Well, we spent a great deal of time talking about, and for China it's pretty much kind of a Buddhist mentality, because even for those who are not Buddhist, that in China they do acquire, you cannot help but acquire, this whole attitude and outlook on things. Well, ever since then, and this was one of the great graces of my studies, besides picking up a doctorate, I made some wonderful friends. This was, of course, also, you can see, the beginning of my interest in Oriental thought. And he told me how much insight he got into Christian spirituality, into, for him, Ignatian thought, by his study of the Buddhist masters. Let me first tell you a little about him and then get back into this and one of the insights that he gave me on the understanding of now number 7. He got his doctorate in pretty good time. He was a hard worker. Very little recreation, always business. Well, Christmas time, he was almost finished. But by Easter time of his second year in graduate study, he was just about finished with his thesis. And he got word from our Father General informing him that his repeated request to go back to China, by this time being taken over by the communists, continental China, were answered. And he was told and given, I think it was 48 hours, by that time he had already finished his thesis, had defended, to leave Rome and go to China. So he was bidding goodbye to his friends, and I happened to be one of his closer friends, I guess. So we talked for a while, and he told me, and as I looked at him, all I could think of was a man who was almost in ecstasy with joy. He was so sure what was awaiting him in China, because he was to become the superior in disguise for the Chinese Jesuits. Be just a matter of time of how long the disguise would last. And the prospect of death would just thrill him. But he was hoping he would be Jesuitical enough to do enough work before he finally died. He knelt down for my blessing, and of course I have to kneel down for his. I felt I was blessed by a saint. I was in touch with him for about a year afterwards. Then I lost sight of him, or contact with him. And about 3 years afterwards, I happened to be working with our provincial in Chicago, and one of the Jesuit missionaries from mainland China was passing through, coming from China, past the west coast, going back to Rome to report to the general on conditions in China. And he stopped for a discussion, a conference with the provincial. Well, after lunch, we talked for a while. That is this missionary and myself, and I asked him, did you by any remote chance in the vast regions of China come upon John Chrysostom Chang? Oh, he says that he was one of the last men that I talked to when I left China. After 3 years, they caught up with him. He was awaiting execution. I have many times prayed to him since. Now, among the things that he told me about the insight that Buddhist spirituality gave him was of the great importance of making sure that before a person ambitions contemplation, his life of moral action is set straight. That anyone who ambitions contemplation, here, right attentiveness in the Buddhist vocabulary, without first having made sure that his passions, his wrong kind of desires, and the whole panoply of his moral life is somewhat in order, is deceiving nobody but himself. Well, this right attentiveness. Now, here again, the right attentiveness is directed to further self-mastery through the contemplation of four kinds of objects. This, of course, is the penultimate stage to concentration, which leads to nirvana. And again, as you read the masters of Buddhism, or for that matter of Hinduism, because much of Hinduism, it should be said, has been deeply affected by Buddhist thoughts. This is, remember, when we're talking about Hinduism and Buddhism, we're talking about mental constructs. People, especially as I mentioned the Buddhists, there are a few Buddhists who are just Simon pure Buddhists. They will have a lot of other religious culture and thought behind them. At any rate, there are four things that are contemplated. And again, as you read this, you can get all kinds of wrong ideas, as though they are trying to induce some sort of hypnotic trance. Now, there's no doubt, and this is one of the favorite complaints of Buddha and since then of his followers, people who jump the gun, people who, so they're 21 years old, it's about time I got into this contemplation. So they do all sorts of things which frankly become antics. Some quite literally standing on their head, because this is one of the things that helps. Because a bit of yoga has been picked up also by Buddhism. At any rate, four kinds of objects are attended to: the body, the feelings, the mind, and phenomena in general. Each is given detailed prescriptions that are found especially in the Digha. This is, I think I have it in your notes. If I don't, let me mention it. It's one of the classic texts, because this is the great treatise on Buddhist contemplation, which is the last step before reaching Nirvana. Digha, D-I-G-H-A hyphen, Nikaya. The Nikaya is kind of a generic term. The treatise, which is in the sermon basket, in other words, one of the sermons purportedly of the Buddha, which is part of Buddha scriptures. Let me briefly describe the concentration, or in this case, I don't want to misuse words, we've got to be technical, the attention, or contemplation, that would be good, of the body, which is the first of the four types of object that should be attended to. It's an elaborate process which consists mainly in a studious attention to every part of one's own anatomy and to every bodily action a man performs. Now, what is the purpose of this? The purpose, as you are beginning to see, is to gradually make the person who so has mastered himself, he's past the stage of having to worry about his right speech, or for that matter, of his right action. His passions are under control. He is now concentrating on the great truths of Buddhism, and part of that attention should be to see, in all reality, here in his body, how those truths are manifested. When I first met this, I recall St. Ignatius, who we are told could get into a mystic trance, mystic experience, on passing through a field of wildflowers. In other words, anything in nature could suddenly wrap him into a state of contemplation, which this, of course, is, which had nothing to do, you might say, with the phenomena as such, but saw in them the implications which, of course, faith would give a person. Let me briefly quote from a modern book of directions. The disciple is clearly conscious in his going and coming, clearly conscious in looking forward and backward, clearly conscious in bending and stretching any part of his body, clearly conscious in eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, clearly conscious in walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep and awakening, clearly conscious of speaking and in keeping silence. See, in other words, that the world outside, now the word conscious is not the best word that the English translator could have. And further, the disciple contemplates this body from the sole of the foot upward and from the top of the hair downward, with the skin stretched over it, Thus he dwells in contemplation of the body, either with regard to his own person or to other persons, or to both. Now, what's the purpose of this? Well, it's to get self-mastery, but you see, it's more than self-mastery by this time to, you might say, control the passions. It is to give mastery over delight and discontent so they don't dislodge the mind from its unique purpose of gradually, surely, but deliberately going closer and closer and deeper into being. The conquest of fear and anxiety in the endurance, I quote now, of cold and heat, hunger and thirst, wind and sun, attacks by gadflies, mosquitoes, and reptiles, of which I am told there are myriads in the Orient. And they will be quite oblivious to this. In fact, a man will be able patiently to endure wicked and malicious speech, as well as bodily pains, though they be piercing, sharp, bitter, even dangerous to life. Now, I could not have more in my notes about describing, but I think you get the idea, don't you? In other words, it is a contemplation whose function is not to be preoccupied, quite the contrary. It may look for all the world as though the concentration is to be preoccupied with, say, so now I'm sitting down. Hereby I sit, so now I'm sitting. No, it is that through the concentration on all of these things, the very concentration on what stands behind that, what does it mean to sit, what does it mean to stand, I am gradually coming into an understanding of reality or the self. Finally then, right concentration. This is rather briskly dealt with in Buddhist writings for the simple reason that by this time things happen. In fact, any person I am told, who can reach that state of contemplation or right attentiveness has to be unaware of pain or suffering, malicious speech. He is so preoccupied with the reality, well, he is just one stage removed from nirvanic sublimation, and consequently, the right concentration, which is a fixation of mind to a single object, resulting in a series of trances, some of which may already have been enjoyed before this time, beginning with rapture, and the only comparable that I can think of is the stages of mystical experience in a woman like Teresa of Avila or a man like John of the Cross. This right concentration assumes by this time complete detachment from sensual things and from demeritorious things. And by detachment, that means that the person has reach that stage where he no longer does things that are, by Buddhist standards, demeritorious. He reaches, I quote now, the fixation of mind to a single object. Literally, one-pointedness of mind, which results in a series of trances, as we mentioned, and then the big thing. It begins with rapture and happiness, and this would still be, by our language, by our standards, happiness, beatitude, but it ends, if we can speak of an end, in a state, if we can speak of a state, and here's the description, and this is the best description that I can find in Buddhist writings, the state beyond pleasure and pain, unquote. Which is nirvana. Well, with that as some explanation of both the fourfold truth, or four noble truths, and the four plus four And by the way, that should be noted. You know, when I broke the Eightfold Path into four and four, that break is also part of Buddhist thinking. The first four representing the ideal, the last four representing the means, in other words, what a person has got to do. And it begins with efforts and ends with, hopefully, nirvanic concentration. Now, we must say something, because what I've described for you, if you wish, is Buddhism in the ideal order. And I hope I am sharing with you not only facts, but some of my own feeling. You see how deeply I have, at least for myself, I don't say understood Buddhism, but at least hopefully fallen in love with it, or with its people. And when I think of millions of Christians not even hearing about this, the only thing I can say, it just saddens me, because of what Christianity has to offer these people. The historical development of Buddhism must be understood to understand modern Buddhism, because modern Buddhism is not just this beautiful picture. Buddhism is people.
This concludes Father Hardin's talk on the Eightfold Path of Nirvana. On the next tape, Father speaks on Buddhist worship and ritual.